Good. I learned a lot, not everything that I didn't understand, everything, of course, that I heard during the last few days, but a couple of things were within my horizon, and I could even widen my horizon. That's, I think, very important. In general, I think it's extremely important for all of us to combine the knowledge of the experimentalists with the theoreticians to see what can be done, to see what is worth doing, and to see, well, to extend our limits. By the way, I was very pleased by the last talk of Simon, because part of this was really within my horizon, totally, and that was MCG. This is the field I'm working on since more than 30 years now, so this is where I really feel at home. So thank you for that. Anyway, this is the outline. This is, I basically want to talk about the experimental possibilities that we have in our lab, rather than talking about too much about our results, so that we can discuss what the possibilities are, and maybe it's also stimulating for you to get new ideas what can be done in addition to that what we are currently doing or planning. So we'll start with the experimental setup, that is basically with the magnetic shielding. This was mentioned already, I think. This is a Berlin magnetically shielded room, number two, so it's the second one of its kind. These are 15 meters, by the way, it's a big building. Inside are seven layers of Muon-Metall. There's one additional layer of eddy currents, for aluminum basically. And then in addition to that, there is an active coil shielding system. It's a cut through this building. You see, this is the outer shape. There is this inner shape that's an RF shield. And in this RF shield, there are coils in each direction of space that compensate, firstly, the Earth magnetic field, and secondly, there's a feedback control to damp the very low frequency perturbations. And altogether, then, we achieve a shielding in the range of more than 10 million. This is a shielding with respect to the frequency, and you see that the shielding becomes more and more difficult the lower the frequency is. So this is done by the Muon-Metall alone and by the other shielding devices, and this is in addition being done by the active shielding, that is by the compensation of the perturbations with using a feedback control. So these are very extraordinary conditions for doing very sensitive magnetic measurements. And another important figure is the residual static field, which is below one nanotesla. The residual static field is different from shielding because what remains inside the room are the fields that are generated by the innermost layer of the room, which is of Muon-Metall, which is magnetic. And so it's very important to get this value very, very low. And this is the concept of our measurements. Well, usually, as I said, measurements in this room are being done, and this room was made for brain current management, heart current management, and also single neuronal excitations. And this has been going on for the last 10 years and is still going on. But in addition to that, we are very enthusiastic about these experiments in low magnetic fields. And if we apply a Helmholtz coil, we can apply a field of one microtesla, which is 50 times lower than the Earth magnetic field. And the perturbations by this room are very small, although not negligible. This is a look inside to this room. This is the door. By the way, the door is the main problem of a shielded room. It would be very nice and very easy to make a perfect shielded room without doors. But you can use it only once. But it's a permanent position in that case. Okay, so the door is really a problem, and we have four sliding doors that operate very well. I will come back to that later. This is the equipment that we're using currently. These are Helmholtz coils. Here you can see the glass bulb, which contains hyperpolarized helium or xenon, or both of them. This is a helium-filled ewer with liquid helium to cool the sender, and the sender is a squid. Well, talking of squids, squids are superconducting quantum interference devices invented, I think, almost exactly 50 years ago. We design squids of our own at PTB. There is Dietmar Drung, who is really a wizard of designing squids, and in fact that his squids are the best in the world in terms of sensitivity. This is a famous cartwheel design that he made. I do not want to go into the details, but just briefly, this is a noise spectrum of our 304-channel system. This is not the best noise spectrum we have. We have better ones, but this is really the system that we are operating presently for a number of reasons. I will come back to this later because it's a big advantage to be able to work with 300 channels simultaneously, or at least with a couple of channels. We don't use all of them in these experiments. In this case, the noise floor is at 3.5 femtotesla per square root hertz. As I said, we can go down below 1 femtotesla in single channel devices. Another important figure is the 1 over F noise, which starts below 3 hertz. Then, unfortunately, we have mechanical vibrations, which are unavoidable to some extent. And of course, there are always ugly interferences of the power line and also sometimes of other experiments that are going on in some other building. This is something we have to deal with, and it's a penalty for being very sensitive that you see everything, even those things that you do not want to see. An important issue in such a room, in the experiments we are talking about this now, it wasn't such an issue for biomagnetic measurements, is the homogeneity of the field. Because this is the kind of data that we acquire. We have a helium cell filled with hyperpolarized helium gas, and we apply this field of, say, a microtesla or so. So the spins of the magnetic moment of the nuclei are precessing with a Lamo frequency. And this can be some 30 hertz or something like that, or 13 hertz or whatever you like. And this is the oscillation that we observe. Now, it is important to have a long relaxation time. In this case, I call it T2 star. The relaxation time or the relaxation rate is given by a number of factors. I think some of this was in a similar way discussed by Simon before. We have a number of effects that decrease the relaxation time, and it's the lifetime of the magnetization. Here I would particularly want to talk about the inhomogeneity of the field. And the inhomogeneity is a big problem to obtain a long relaxation time, but we are very proud that we managed in helium to achieve a relaxation time of more than 100 hours. Yes, please?
Do you have the degauss every time you open the door?
Let me come back to this in a minute. Yes, that's a good question. No, we don't have to, just to give a short answer. We have Helmholtz coils, and you may notice that we have 3 Helmholtz coils, actually. You may ask why this is necessary. The reason is that we have a particular or peculiar way to shim the room, the magnetic field. Usually, shimming is done by manipulating the applied field by adding gradients and other things, and that is a technology of its own in high-field NMR spectrometers. In low fields, things are a bit different because we have to fight against 2 sources of inhomogeneity. One, of course, is the applied field of the coils, but this is a Helmholtz coil and it has homogeneities of 10 to the minus 4 or 10 to the minus 5 or something like that. But in addition to that, we have the inhomogeneity of the residual field. The residual field is small, but its structure is a mess. It's just something that has built up after the last demagnetization. And it's very difficult to handle. But the way we handle this now is, in first order, the inhomogeneity is given by the gradient, linear term. And we have 2 gradients, one of the Helmholtz coils and the other of the residual field. And so we orient the applied field in a way that these 2 gradients compensate. And this is how we can, in one direction, achieve very good values for the relaxation time, for the homogeneity. This is somehow the mystery about how to shim such a magnetic field.
But is it really sort of a reproducible fact? Or you just have
it's just like shimming. It's just like shimming a high field magnet. It's something you have to do before you experiment.
Well, but I mean, your line cancellation is 2 gradients. There's no reason why they should be similar in size. So the fact that they
that's correct. That's correct.
Is,
yeah. But you cannot. But of course, you can also adjust the size. I mean, you can also adjust the amplitude. of the applied field.
Well, what about the image current produced by the Hubble coil in the shielded throne?
In the walls.
In the walls, for sure.
It's a problem. Of course, it's very difficult to predict how the walls react to what you apply. And this is exactly our business to optimize this. So it's really something like which cannot be done just by pushing on a button or so. It's really just like shimming a high field magnet. It's something that has to be done before the experiment. And I do not claim that any time we start an experiment, we are able to reach 100 hours, of course, but we can reach it. It's a difficult thing. It's experimental physics. Okay, this is the uncertainty that we obtain when we measure relaxation of oscillation over a long time. This is called the Kramer-Rau lower bound. And given the values that are achieved here, we have 100 hours of relaxation time, of lifetime of the magnetization. We can take a bandwidth of, say, 1 hertz. Signal-to-noise ratio is in the range of 1,000 for hyperpolarized helium. And this factor tells that it doesn't make much sense to observe longer than T2 star. So this is 1 if you stop at T2 star. It gets lower if you go to longer time, so it doesn't help much. So altogether, we can reach a resolution in frequency of 3 times 10 to the minus 12 hertz, 12 picohertz. In terms of test of field resolution, it's 10 to the minus 20. And in terms of energy resolution, it's 10 to the minus 26. This is very optimistic, but it may work. But of course, we have other problems. And I will come to this now. And this leads us to co-magnetometry. Okay. What happens if we close the door? Now I come back to your question, and then you see this effect that there's a drift, and after that you have a condition that the field goes up and down in a range of about 0.3 picotesla. This is something that spoils, of course, the very nice field of frequency resolution. And to the remedy against this, to observe 2 nuclei at the same time, in xenon and helium. I would like to draw your attention to this, which is, of course, annoying to some extent, that closing the door has an effect. But on the other hand, note that this is just 10 minutes. And this is extremely important, I can tell you. I know of other rooms which are very nice, working very well. But once you open the door, you have to demagnetize the room for 3-4 hours, and then you can continue your experiment. So in our room, you can just build up your experiment, close the door, wait 10 minutes, make the measurement, then you see you want to change something in the setup. So you open the door, change, close the door, 10 minutes later can continue to work. It's extremely important for the practical work. Okay, co-magnetometry. Xenon and helium. So this is how the superposition of both of them look. And if you then subtract the frequencies in a weighted way, then this should be 0. Of course, this is not true. Because firstly, we have some uncertainty in the determination of the ratio of the gyromagnetic ratios. And if we have a xenon frequency of 4 hertz, it makes up some 3 microrad per second. So this is not negligible. But there's another effect that makes delta omega different from 0, and that is the Earth rotation. We are not living in an inertial system here. We are on a rotating system. The Earth rotates by 23 hours plus 56 minutes or so. And this is not negligible. So if you calculate all this through, then you end up at a drift given by 68 microrad per hertz. You have to take into account the geographical latitude of our laboratory and also the bearing, that is how the magnetic field is oriented with respect to the Earth axis. Altogether, this means that helium and xenium have a drift, but if you make the weighted difference, then you end up at a finite value of about 9 microhertz in this case. And the interesting thing about this is that we have an uncertainty for reasons I explained before. So there may be something hidden in this drift, something mysterious, something exotic interaction, but we cannot tell because we have an uncertainty here. So we cannot exactly say if there is something. Okay, so let me now come back to the experiments that we are doing presently or going to do or have done in the last few years. This is our multi-channel system containing 300 squids at various locations. We apply a magnetic field to this helium cell, and this means basically we observe the Larmor frequency, the Larmor splitting. And if then some non-magnetic interactions come into the play, then we expect, if it is there, that we have a change in the frequency, that something adds to the Larmor frequency. And if this is time dependent, then this is something like this. So we observe then a change, a modulation of the frequency. In the other case, it was just a change of the frequency. And this is what we need. We need some sort of a modulation. We need to have some sort of a change in order to observe something. And one thing we are presently building up together with Peter Fehrlinger from the Technical University of Munich is a search for an electric dipole moment of xenon in a cell which is in which a strong magnetic field, a strong electric field can be set up. And we expect if we apply the field and we reverse the field that we then should observe a change in this energy levels, which should be displayed by a change in the frequency. And from this change, we could observe or could calculate how strong the xenon dipole electric moment is. Another experiment that we did a few years ago was searching for axions. In this case, we were searching for the interactions between heavy mass and the nuclei, which is mediated by axions. And again, we have to modulate this by moving and removing this heavy mass. It's a BGO, it's a bismuth germanium oxide crystal. And what the result was, we did not observe anything. The frequency did not change significantly when moving or removing this this heavy mass, so that we could exclude a certain range of possible existence of these virtual axions. And another thing that is very interesting that we have been working also on during the last few years is the modulation that could possibly originate from a violation of the Lorentz invariance, which should modulate the frequency in a period that corresponds to one sidereal day, that is by the Earth's rotation, which is modulating the relative velocity of the lab with respect to some postulated background reference frame. I think Mike Romales is going to talk about this a little more in the next talk. Okay, so let me close with considerations about how we can detect axion wind using squid-based co-magnetometry. Again, the idea is the same. We have the squids, we have our field, we have the helium. In this case, we have only helium. We do not heat xenon. And it's inspired by the work of Peter Graham and Sujit Rajendran, who speculated about the interaction that could occur between the helium nuclei and the galactic axions. So now these axions, according to this model, should modulate the precession frequency of the nuclei. It means the axion should act as if there was an additional field that modulates the applied field by some amplitude and by some frequency. The problem is we do not know the amplitude and we do not know the frequency. So we had some thoughts about how this might look like in our experiment. And in fact, this is very simple. We observe helium, by the way. In this way, we have a Larmor precession at the Larmor frequency of helium. And we have this interaction, or we have this frequency of the axions, of the axion-like particles. And if this modulates this frequency by this frequency, then we should just see two sidebands. That's all. Very simple. How can we distinguish this from an artifact? Because this might be also due to some perturbation that comes into the lab from some source we do not know. But the answer is easy. In this case, we could see also this perturbation in the squid. And this indicates that using a squid for this kind of detection, we already have a magnetometer. We have not only one way to measure magnetic fields, we have two ways. And if the nuclei see something different from the squids, then we can say there must be something additional be going on. Okay, what is the situation, which is, I think, much more realistic if the axion frequency is higher than the Larmor frequency of the nuclei, then it looks like this. And now the sidebands look like this, so that this sideband is in the negative range. This means it is reflected, so that it appears here. So the pattern that we expect in this case is the Larmor frequency of the nucleus and two sidebands, but in a which are located symmetrically about the frequency of the axion or the axion-like particle, and they're separated by twice the Larmor frequency. So it's a very clear and unambiguous pattern. And again, if we have a magnetic perturbation that does the same, then we would have a line observable of this magnetic perturbation. So it's again very clear to identify such interactions. Okay, we did this also experimentally. I do not mean to say that we observed axions, but we observed artifacts that we made by ourselves. So this is a helium signal at 32 hertz or something like that. And in addition to that, there is a lot of perturbations. You know, this is just the range about 32 hertz. But if you look further, we see the power line, and we see other magnetic distortion of some colleague in another building who's doing just some experiment or so. So we must not mistake anything of this with what we are looking for. But if we now add the modulation of the magnetic field artificially, then we see, of course, two sidebands, as it should look like. In this case, we used a very small frequency of 1.5 hertz. What happens in the situation that the frequency of modulation is much higher, higher than the Larmor frequency? In that case, we see, again, our perturbations, but we also see other lines. We see the helium line, and we see the two sidebands of the helium, this one here and the other one here. These are sidebands of this line. One is reflected, this is this one, and this is the real sideband. But we also see, of course, because we generated an artifact modulation frequency by which we can identify that this is not coming from any exotic interaction. Okay, we did this not just for fun or just to reproduce what we are had in our minds, but we used these kind of experiments to estimate how sensitive we are. And this is basically the answer. The answer is that if the modulation frequency induced by the axions is very small, then we are very sensitive also to small amplitudes, which correspond to, say, 10 femtotesla or so. But this is for 0.001 hertz, 1 millihertz, I think. I'm afraid this is not very realistic. And if we go higher to the frequency, up to the 100 hertz or even to the kilohertz range, then we must have very high amplitudes of this modulation to make them detectable. So up to now, we can say that this is a possible measurement range, and we didn't observe anything up to now in this range that looks like an axion.
What do you mean by saying it's not realistic?
Well, that's what I learned from you. I think it's worth just mentioning that in this range we don't see anything that looks like an axion. And
very interesting.
But it's still like as a particle that could exist at 0.001 hertz. It's currently not ruled out by anything else. For DQCD axion, but for axion-like particles, that's a very open parameter space.
So it's a finding, if you want.
Absolutely,
I'm very happy about this. finding that may at least a little bit meaningful.
Yeah.
And there's a little bit room because we used our multi-channel system, and we can also use a single-channel system, which has a lower noise. It's the second line here, from 2 femtotesla to 0.5 femtotesla. That's what we could do. In this case, we have a shorter distance that would increase the amplitude again, and we can also use higher pressure because we do not need long relaxation times. I didn't mention that increasing the pressure reduces relaxation time, but in this case, we do not rely on this, so we can get higher in the amplitude, and altogether, we might make another factor of 200 or so, and this might be worth doing it. In that case, we could explore this room up to here, but this is, at the moment, at least to me, this is the end of the line. Okay, I'm through. I've addressed all these points, and I would like to make the following points as a conclusion from my talk. In order to look for such exotic interaction, we need strong magnetic shielding. We need some sort of a modulation, a variation of the interaction in order to see it. Otherwise, it's just it's there, hidden, and we don't notice it's there. We have helium, xenium, co-magnetometry, but also if we just use a squid and one of the nuclei, we have a co-magnetometer. I think this is an important issue. It's also important, I think, for the discussion about this detection of domain walls, because we should be able, if such a wall crossing occurs, to see it in the precession frequency, but not in the squid. And up to now, we have no indication of axion interaction with our nuclei. I would like to thank my collaborators and colleagues in PTB, and part of the studies I've shown were done together with the group of Werner Heil and with Peter Fierlinger, and German Research Foundation also supported us with some money. Thank you.
So let's take a few questions.
So if things work with the EDM experiment, what kind of potential sensitivity can you achieve for xenon EDM?
I don't have the figure in my mind, but we expect to be one order of magnitude than Tim Chubb's results published.
What is your electric field?
A couple of kilovolt. Let's see what we can stand and what the how the squid reacts, because switching electric field might cause some problems with the squids. We still gathering the experience in this, so several kilovolts.
What's the stability of the field over the course of a day, the thermal environment?
In our room?
Yeah.
2-3 picotesla, something like that.
Usually people say that the results are too good to be true, but I think that in this case, I'm wondering if they are too bad to be true. It seems like you should be able to do much better in this last discussion of the axion stuff. Well, mm-hmm. Certainly if you go on resonance, perhaps you should do better. I don't know if you have thought about that.
What could I do to become better?
If you go on resonance, if you actually...
Yes, okay, that's... Yes, okay, this yeah. is... Yes, cool.
But this never is... without that, it seems like it's... It seems like you could do better, but...
Yeah, yeah, well, the cost per proposal is all resonant, right? So...
Yeah.
Well, but yeah, but it's sort of similar to that, but it's
Actually, I have a question. So, in earlier on, you were talking about the importance of the rotation of the Earth and your signal and something, and I'm looking for a spin gravity coupling, and that is a problem for me too. And so, I adopted the strategy of the Washington group, who did a similar experiment in 1982 with mercury spins. Where the idea is to align the magnetic field with the Earth's rotation axis.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
And so that way, it turns out in that configuration, the misalignment between the magnetic field and the Earth's rotation axis only introduces an uncertainty or systematic error in quadratically.
Yeah.
Now, I noted in your setup, right, you instead align your magnetic field kind of along the axis to sort of minimize the gradient coupling.
Yep.
So I guess my question was, and you noted that there's some noise and uncertainty in this precession frequency. So I guess my question is that noise and precession frequency consistent with, say, and there's this 0.3 picotesla variation?
Yeah.
So that should introduce some pointing error exactly in the signal. Is that, are those two consistent? Is that?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, that's
a
very good comment. And I think there's two ways to work with the Earth rotation. One is just to align, and the other is just to go perpendicular to the Earth's rotation, because in that case you can very precisely calculate, because cosine is a is a function which is goes like this if you are in the right, have the right angle, and then the arrow that you have in the bearing is not so important. So that's I think something we can improve, but we have to make a trade-off with the homogeneity of the field, and this makes things delicate.
I may have a very naive question. So is there any particular advantage of doing this in a magnetically shielded room rather than doing it in a smaller shield in your system? It's easier to shield. It's easier to shield something smaller, I believe, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
So is there... I mean, maybe this argument of, you know, switching the field...
Yeah. There is, if you do co-magnetometry, then you have a couple of systematic errors you have to think about. One of them is, for instance, I told you about moving this BGO close and far away from the sample. It has a susceptibility. Also in the field that we apply, there's a susceptibility which is not negligible. This, of course, in the first order acts to both nuclei, but the xenon nuclei is heavier, so it has a different center of gravity. And so this effect is stronger if you have less good shielding. And I think it's for a number of second order effects, it's very important to have a very good shielding.
All right, well, thanks.